And welcome to this Pledge Drive edition of Midday. My guest today is Baltimore City Councilman Mark Conway. He represents the 4th District on the council, which includes some of the city's most affluent neighborhoods like Guilford and Homeland, as well as the York Road corridor and other North Baltimore neighborhoods. Councilman Conway also chairs the Public Safety Committee, and Mark Conway joins me here in Studio A. Councilman, good to see you.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
So your committee held a hearing on Tuesday about its public safety committee, but this was about infrastructure, wasn't it? Because we've found all too often some of our very ancient infrastructure is a threat to public safety.
Yeah, we've been having some issues in our conduit. In the last couple of years, we've had a number of fires on the ground that have resulted in some significant safety issues, not only for the folks in the area, the businesses and otherwise, but also for our firefighters that are trying to respond to these fires. Fires on the ground are really, really hard to get to. And so it's a challenge for us every time this happens. And I wanted to make sure we held a hearing about it so we can understand why these things are happening so that we can do whatever exists within our power to make sure that they don't happen in the future.
And understanding why they happen, how they happen, is no easy matter, is it?
No, it's not. Unfortunately, every time this happens, everything burns out, and it's really hard to figure out what the cause of the fire was. We do know, though, that there are only a couple of things that can lead to a fire underground, and there are a couple of infrastructure pieces that can play a part in that. One of the things that came from the hearing was that the city has hired a third-party vendor to do that investigation, and I think we're working toward a solution here, or at least an understanding of what caused at least the latest fire. One thing that I noticed in the hearing, I'd requested data about fires on the ground over the last 10 years, and one of the probably most surprising things in the data that came out was a spike in 2018 and in 2014. Every year.
That's weird, isn't it?
Yeah, it was really,
those
really
two
weird.
Particular years.
Yeah, and you know, as I asked folks what they believed what was going on there, no one really in the room understood what was going on. And so I think there's something going on here. I want to figure out what we can do to address it. But, the last time we had this hearing, we had a hearing on exactly this issue last November because there was an underground fire that resulted in an explosion. It really, really damaged a couple of buildings. And really, I think, spooked a lot of folks in the area. It took out communications. It took out power for a while, which, you know, was a real challenge to some of the businesses and residents in the area.
Yeah, and it was on Charles Street, too.
It was on Charles Street.
A major thoroughfare.
Right, in the heart of the city. So I think, it's something that's a real big problem for us. We want to figure out what we can do, what's causing it, and respond expeditiously.
At that hearing on Tuesday, the chief of the fire department, James Wallace, testified, and this is what he said when you asked him about what we knew at this point about what led up to the most recent fires. Here's what he had to say.
What was burning, what was actively burning, where the flames were being emitted, is at the very least the wiring and the cable. Mm-hmm. The challenge with us is when we arrive at these, normally the power arcs, the power flashes, are so strong and in a lot of cases so violent that we can't get up on this hole and take a look at it. Oftentimes it also will either initially involve more than one manhole, or it'll begin to migrate, and it'll migrate by way of the conduits. So one of the fires back in 2018, I was actually on as a field officer, and it was migrating from hole to hole until we could actually get the power shut off. Then the challenge is, how do we get to that fire, right? It's in the conduits. You saw the pictures there. Some of the conduit tubes are small. How do we get to that? So I think what's oftentimes is a challenge is, what caused this to start? What caused this to happen?
That's Fire Chief James Wallace. It's a little disconcerting when the fire chief doesn't know what caused it. There's some speculation. What did you hear? Where'd you learn anything in that regard?
So I think there's a little bit of everyone trying to be careful here, a little bit of self-protection with all the folks that operate within the conduit and play party in this. The city, BGE, vicinity that is not in the conduit, but their infrastructure is often very close and could be a part of the problem. So I see a lot of dodginess around what's actually going on here. And, you know, our big priority in the committee is to make sure that we understand what's going on. I don't care whose fault it is. What I want to do is make sure that we can ensure the safety of Baltimoreans that are and visitors that are walking around downtown in these areas. The businesses that are disrupted, the folks that are counting on power and communications that go through this conduit. So it's a real, real important puzzle for us to fix. And what I want to make sure we don't do is point fingers and blame folks and not get to the root of the issue, because I think everyone's counting on us.
Talk a little bit about what a conduit is. It's a conduit for a bunch of wires, isn't it?
Yes. So Baltimore is one of the only cities that actually owns its conduit, technically. And what it is a series of tubes that hold wires underground. These wires are everything from power lines to fiber and communications. And we use this across the, not the entire city, but really our downtown area. The problem, though, arises with the age of the conduit. Baltimore is one of the first cities to make a conduit and then therefore own the conduit. And a lot of that conduit is made of terracotta that is, you know, 100 years old almost at this point. And it's incredibly brittle. It falls apart pretty easily. If you tap it, it'll shatter, and yeah. then
great
it collapses.
For planting geraniums, but yeah. not so hot for
protecting your wires. Yeah. Yes, and so this becomes a challenge in various parts around the city. We've been strategically replacing that, and that's an agreement that we have with BGE, and it's really important that we are very strategic about what we prioritize because things like this happen. But all that said, it's really difficult to identify what's causing the fires at this moment, and that's really what worries me.
I mean, I know there was some speculation at the hearing that these wires heat up. Yes. And, you know, any of us have that experience in our own homes, in our offices. I mean, you plug your computer in and all of a sudden 3 hours later that, you know, the wire itself seems hot. Sometimes your phone just gets hot for some reason. You know, you turn it off, you let it sit there for 5 minutes, you turn it back on and it's okay. But heat is generated with these wires. Is there any data to suggest that, you know, the wires themselves are simply heating and they get to the point where they just burst into flames?
So I took the liberty to try to speculate a little bit in the middle of the hearing. And because I'm not an electrical engineer, everyone can ignore me. But I do know, yes, wires can heat up and that can be a part of the problem. We don't know that that's the problem necessarily, but it can be. We know that in instances where electrical wires interact with water or steam or moisture in any way, that could also lead to a spark that then can spread to a fire. But my theory here is that there are only a couple of things that can cause a fire underground. And if we began to look into exactly what those things underground are that can lead to a spark or a fire, being more pointed in our infrastructure upgrades around those things can be a really important strategy going forward.
Now, you mentioned that the city of Baltimore owns the conduits, but yes. without some pretty significant controversy, yeah. BGE has, been contracted to take care of them. So what is BGE's role in this? What did you hear from them? And how do you see that relationship moving forward? Is this at all, in your view, related to how BGE is caring for the conduit?
Yeah, so this was a pretty nuanced line of questioning that I had during the hearing regarding an agreement that the city made with BGE in 2013, in which we allowed, generally BGE was one of many tenants within the conduit, but they occupy 75% of the conduit. So they're our largest tenant within the conduit. What we did is we got into an agreement by which they gave us $120 million and, you know, we'll continue to pay $1.5 million a year. I won't bore you with all the numbers, but they gave us a big lump sum of money so that they would then be responsible for capital upgrades. Why that got a little bit interesting is because now BGE determines where they're going to do the capital upgrades, not necessarily the city.
And that's why so many people oppose that deal. I mean, yeah. You know, the Board of Estimates took a while to finally sort that out. The mayor supported that deal and he was able to push it through. Of course, we all know that the mayor has a majority of, votes on the Board of Estimates. So, but BGE did or does have the authority and the, the wherewithal to decide we're going to do this one, we're not going to do that one.
Right. And this is the interesting thing. We know that safety is a priority here. That's the whole reason why we called that hearing. And this is why we're going to continue to focus on it. I expect we'll bring it back to the committee when we get that report back in late fall, likely. But while BGE determines ultimately where they want to invest capital to improve the conduit, hopefully to reduce the likelihood that we have these fires, I also know that BGE, when they make capital investments, then puts that on our bills, and they're able to charge a premium for any capital investments. And we know everyone has been really kicking and screaming about the cost of their energy bills, including myself. So I think there's a depending on how big of a problem this is, I'm really curious about once we identify what the problems are and identify what solutions we need to employ, and we then go to BGE and say, hey, we want to do this to make sure that we can ensure our downtown is safe from fires in the future, that we're not seeing, because of this agreement, significant increases in people's energy bills. Because this is a necessity. We want to make sure we ensure safety. But I think people have been crying uncle for a while now, just in the last year, as we've seen energy prices go up.
And do the folks from BGE have any suggestion? As you mentioned, they're occupying 75%. Most of those wires are theirs. And even they could not, shed all that much light on what was happening.
Yeah. And I would say it's in the best interest of BGE as well. They've got a number, of course, tons of customers in the area that are counting on power. And it is, of course, one of their highest priorities, safety, and then, ensuring supply of power. It's going to be really important for them to ensure that they don't continue to lose power every time this happens. So I think we are all looking for a solution here, and we need one expeditiously. We didn't exactly get that in our hearing on Tuesday, but my hope is that when we get this third-party vendor's report back, we'll have a better sense of what's going on. My thing, though, is that even with that report, I'm not sure necessarily that it will tell us about what happened in our previous fires. In 2018, where we saw 10 fires. In 2024, where we saw 10 fires. And why it's so different from the in-between years. So I think this is going to be an issue that's just a little bit more complicated than one would hope. But I think we have to be persistent in looking into the problems here.
Back. It's midday. Coming up tomorrow on the show, WYPR News Director Matt Bush is going to be sitting in for me for the Midday News Wrap. He'll speak with WYPR's Scott Mausioni about some of his new reporting on the Dali, the ship that rammed into the Key Bridge last year, and John Lee, who will update us on the status of the appointment of an inspector general in Baltimore County. Plus, Matt will speak with Adam Willis of our news partner, the Baltimore Banner, about how cuts to FEMA will affect communities on the Eastern Shore. So that's on the way tomorrow. And if you've just joined us today, my guest is Baltimore City Councilman Mark Conway. He represents the 4th District, and he chairs the Public Safety Committee. Councilman Conway joins me here in Studio A. You are welcome to join us as well. This is a different number than you use to pledge. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. You can drop us an email, midday@wypr.org. We're talking about infrastructure and public safety. So, Councilman Conway, you are, of course, as I mentioned, the chair of the Public Safety Committee. And we've had in recent weeks some terrible tragedies involving police who have shot and killed three people who apparently were involved in behavioral and mental health crises. A very sad situation all around. What are you hearing from the police? I know you meet regularly with Commissioner Worley. You're paying attention. What should we know?
Well, first, I think we are all really kind of struggling with not only the instances that happened with the three police involved shootings, but also just the closeness of them, that they happen so close together. It's been tough. Frankly, I think it's been tough for the city, and I think there's been a lot of worry about what that represents and what's been going on. I think you know, we've been seeing some significant improvements in our police department, honest attempts to be better at what they do. And I think they have come a long way. I think, though, these three instances still show us that we still have a ways to go. And we have significant practices and procedures that could benefit from some updates and some better informed approaches. So in each of these instances, we know that the victim or the person involved in the shooting in each of the three shootings were dealing with some sort of mental health crisis, or at least it seemed to be so in all of the calls. At least one of the calls, there were 20 plus calls about mental health issues for that household. And, you know, one of the things that we've been piloting for some time now, I want to say we started this pilot in 2022 or so.
Yeah.
We had a dual responder model for certain emergency calls, noting that just because someone calls 911 doesn't mean necessarily that a police officer is best suited to respond to that issue. When we rolled out the pilot before, it was for folks who were dealing with ideation of suicide and things like that. And we tried to expand that model.
So the dual responder is police may go to the call, but they are accompanied by
a public health
social worker or a public health person.
Exactly. Someone who is specially trained to deal with those issues. We've also been offering training for our police officers on exactly these kinds of scenarios. We haven't quite had quite the participation that I think we'd like to see in the training. And it begs the question, what can we do to further incentivize it or maybe even require it so that officers are much more thoughtful when walking into these instances so that they don't turn violent with folks who are dealing with mental health issues?
That's interesting because, you know, I know it's only about 13%. I was talking to Council President Zeke Cohen about this just a couple of days ago. About 13% of the police force so far has received that training, that crisis intervention training. But it's optional? I mean, I just assumed it was required and they just haven't gotten around to training everybody.
It is optional. And I think that's something that we're going to have to look into and figure out if it's a matter of better incentives or flat out requiring it to happen going forward. I think the other thing that we've also been looking into is back at that dual responder model and what it could mean for a more nuanced approach in these instances. We've done it in the past. We've seen benefits in those instances in the past. And so I think there is an opportunity here, but we have to think about the costs. We have to think about how it actually works from a dispatch perspective. And I think that's something that we're going to look into soon. And, you know, the council president and I have had a number of conversations on this, and we were going to call initially a hearing in the public safety committee, but thought that it would be better in a committee of the whole so that we could have the entire city council play part in this. You know, I had a hearing 2 weeks ago in the public safety committee where we were talking about the Police Accountability Board. And for those that aren't familiar, the Police Accountability Board is geared towards having civilians oversee when the police department is called out for overreach or overstepping boundaries. And it wasn't technically geared toward this issue, but it is certainly relevant. And I'll tell you, the testimony that we got from folks and the frustration that we heard from folks was palpable. So, you know, people want to see a change here. And I know our department knows it needs to change here. And, you know, we're looking to figure out what the next steps will be and why we're here. So after this coming hearing,
There's an organization called the Campaign for Justice, Safety and Jobs, which is a kind of a conglomerate of various nonprofits in the area. And they submitted some written testimony for the recent hearing that you held. And by the way, I think the Committee of the Whole hearing that you're talking about is the 27th of August. Is that, am I correct?
That sounds right. Yes.
Yeah. At 5 o'clock at City Hall. But the Campaign for Justice, Safety, and Jobs made some recommendations. The first is that the BPD, the police department, review and revise its use of force and de-escalation policies. That part of it is part of the current consent decree under which the police department is obliged to do all sorts of things. There shouldn't be much of a barrier to that. I mean, if in fact the policies, the escalation or de-escalation policies are somehow not clear or not effective. That seems like an easy one, doesn't it?
It does. So with the consent decree, there are a couple of steps that the department has to take in order to satisfy the consent decree. First is identifying the issues, then creating policies to address those issues, and then training on those issues and then actually implementing that training. I think now we're in the sort of training phase. We've got 13% of officers that actually train to have this approach going forward, and it's nowhere near where it needs to be. And so I think that's got to be an important step, making sure that our officers actually know what to do in these situations.
And one of the other recommendations that this group made was to publicize more extensively the 988 helpline. Yes. Not 911.
Yes.
So that sometimes when folks call, if they have a family member or a friend who's experiencing a mental health crisis, you call the counselors first before you call the police. That's a hard one to reprogram people for, because we're used to calling 911 when there's a problem.
Yeah, 988 is a new resource. It's been around for about 2 years now, and it's been really helpful in instances where people are having mental health crises for any number of reasons, and it's an awesome resource for folks. The system for calls always existed, but it was some long number that no one could remember. But 988 is memorable. And so I think, you know, finding ways to coordinate our responses with 988 and our crisis response efforts could be a way to go. But I think we're going to have to dig into this and make sure that we have an appropriate response. There are going to be instances where we still need an officer in order to ensure the safety of the public health professional, the mental health professional, should they arrive on the scene. And we need to figure out what that response should look like. And, I think we have to have that conversation.
Yeah, and this is, such a difficult, nuanced, tough problem to solve, because the folks in the mental health community would tell you, it's fine, you know, somebody calls us and we'll go out and respond. But what if that incident turns violent? You know, I mean, one of the women, a 70-year-old woman, you mentioned that this is a family who'd called police some 20 times. This is Prakasha Clark Brooks. She was wielding a knife. Now, she's a 70-year-old woman. There's all sorts of questions as to why the police broke down her door to enter her, her residence.
Yeah.
And there's a, bunch of investigations going on, the AG's office, the police themselves. And we're going to have to wait to see what those, produce. But it's every incident is different, of course, and it's hard to know, is this a dangerous situation for a social worker or a psychologist or a mental health professional?
Yeah, all that said, I think, and this is sort of the conversation that I've been having with folks, one in the hearing and two offline. I think technically by police policy and procedure, did they do something wrong by defending themselves? We will probably find that technically she lunged at them. But what could we have done from a police policy procedure to not put them in that situation? And that's a broader question that we should ask every time we get a call like this. How do we prevent this from ever getting to a point where they are susceptible to someone who is having a mental health crisis responding with violence? And, you know, at the end of the day, these are officers with guns, and they have lethal weapons, and we don't want them to use them unless they absolutely have to. And if you, instead of kicking down the door, maybe approach that with a different approach, we wouldn't have been in this situation. And not to say that, you know, the officers did anything wrong. Maybe they were not trained on how to address this issue, but I can tell you, no one's going to tell you that that's the outcome that they want to see, not even the officers there.
And of course, you're bringing up the very important issue of accountability. You know, once these incidents happen, you mentioned the Police Accountability Board. A lot of folks think that the independence of the civilian review boards, the Police Accountability Board, is somewhat attenuated because, for example, they don't have subpoena power, and they don't have the power to do the kinds of investigations when complaints are brought to them that they wish they had. Do you see any light in that window? Is that something that your committee is going to explore further?
Yeah. So in our hearing, we had a conversation both with the Police Accountability Board and the Administrative Charging Committee. So the Administrative Charging Committee actually reviews individual cases and determines if an officer overstepped their boundaries. And so that body does have subpoena power. But the Police Accountability Board, which really looks at broad policies and trends and makes recommendations to the commissioner about changes to policies, they don't. I think this is something that we should be talking about and figuring out what's appropriate. But at the end of the day, we want to make sure that this body can appropriately inform police policy and procedure to reduce these kinds of incidents. Every time it happens, it's a tragedy. And nobody wants to see their loved one in a moment of crisis end up a casualty. So, I think, you know, they made a number of recommendations. That was one of them. They made a number of recommendations also about independence from city agencies and control of their own budget. And I think these are all things that could make them better. We have to figure out what's appropriate and what the state law allows us to do.
Last year, there were more than 2,200 total complaints about police conduct. That sounds like a lot, but it's actually a whole lot less than it has been in years past, that's for sure. That's one of the reasons we have a consent decree. About 46% of those complaints were sustained. Mm-hmm. So, people are not evidently, using this as just some way to, complain about every time they run into a police officer. But obviously, this is something that you all are going to continue. In our last minute here or so, I do want to ask you about a weird incident that happened. I wouldn't call it an incident, but a weird situation. There were some people in your district, the 4th District, up on York Road, who wanted to have a music festival. Mm-hmm. And that required closing the road for a while. Now, York Road's a major thoroughfare. I mean, a lot of people travel on York Road, and there were mm-hmm. people who were going to be inconvenienced by that. They were not, and you were not, able to convince the powers that be at the city, whoever makes that determination, that closing York Road was okay for this one afternoon of a festival. Yeah. It seemed that you and the mayor were at loggerheads about that. The mayor himself, even commented about it. Can you shed some light on what went down?
Sure. I can kind of walk you back as best as possible. So this is a convenient timing for it to happen. The mayor and I had run-ins in the past around opioids, which I thought we'd come to an agreement and we were on the same page. We had, the crab cake summit, as some may have called it. And I thought we walked away as partners working toward a solution. And I thought we were in a good place. And I thought we put that issue behind us for the most part. We then had another disagreement recently during the budget. My concerns around the Baltimore City Youth Fund and the administration's decision to take funds from the Youth Fund, despite the charter being very clear that that should not happen. It was an issue that led me to vote against the budget. It was not a decision that I wanted to make, but I felt in an instance where a charter amendment where 82% of the city voted for it to exist in that way, that we were going to support youth programming in communities funded by community organizations that are on the ground and know their young people the best. I didn't feel comfortable with the mayor's office taking money and using it for its own priorities, especially when it says specifically within our charter that we are not to do that. That's not what the money is for. So my decision to vote against the budget, and I think previous run-ins with the administration, the mayor, I think have resulted, unfortunately, in political retaliation. We planned for this festival. We started planning in March. We submitted our permits in April, and everything seemed to be moving smoothly. About a month and a half before, we had a meeting with all the city agencies, and they had no real concerns about moving forward. So we thought that we were going to get our permit. And then a couple of weeks before the event, we heard some nebulous complaints from someone in the mayor's office that there were problems with our event. So we tried to nail it down, and one issue changed to another issue, changed to another issue as we resolved it each time. Eventually we got to just a week out from the event, and we were told that they were not going to approve it despite our attempts to adjust the size and location of the event, which has put us in a really tough situation.
It is a tough situation, and obviously everybody in the city hopes that you guys can keep talking and work something out, because there's a lot of people involved in planning that kind of thing, and they plan it for weeks and months, and then it all just gets pulled out from under them. That's too bad.
So. Well, we're working on doing the event anyway. It's going to happen August 30th. We're still choosing a location, and my hope is that this time everything will go smoothly.
We hope that as well. Baltimore City Councilman Mark Conway, he is the chair of the Public Safety Committee. Councilman, it's always good to see you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.